Today I've called it preliminaries because there are a number of things we want to sort of clear the decks on and see where we're starting in our studies on the secret doctrine. You remember that in those of you who have been brave enough to stay with me, people like Jean here and John Reuschlin, Virginia, there have been quite a few who have stuck with me through what have been 11 series that we have spent so far on the secret doctrine, some shorter series and some longer series. And in our last one, we examined the three new propositions, and that's why I put those in blue, that sort of the blue of the past, review, whatever. The three propositions which were given by HPB as fundamental for an understanding of the esoteric tradition as it relates to anthropogenesis, which is, of course, the subject of the entire second volume. Now, I'll warn all of you that my references are always to the pagination of the original edition, but really to the 1979 edition, which was prepared by Boris Dzerkov, thoroughly checked, as you may recall, by him, and the checking of the Sanskrit, Hebrew, Greek words all updated by him, and the Sanskrit particularly put into the now accepted scholarly presentation of the diacritical marks, which was not true in HPB's day. So the references are all to that. The pagination of the 1979 edition is the same pagination as the original edition. So that's why I can say that it's the pagination there. There is a concordance for reference to the Adyar 6th volume edition. And, of course, it's not too difficult to find much of this in the abridgment, those of you who have the abridgment. But these three fundamental concepts, which we've already discussed, so I'm not going to take them up again, but I want to call your attention to them simply. The first is the simultaneous, and that's an important word here, simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of our globe. Now, as I say, I don't want to go into this fully again because we have, of course, taken it up already. But the important point is that this is obviously not speaking of what we have come to call the seven root races, or seven major developmental stages, since it is simultaneous. So it must have to do, very simply, perhaps the easiest way to put it, is that it has to do with the classes of monads that come into existence. And what HPB says, that she calls them the lunar, the moon gods, they, the moon gods. We find this in Shloka 13, actually, and I'll come to this in a moment. They went each on his allotted land, seven of them, each on his lot. Now, when it's speaking of moon gods, we'll be looking at this more, particularly next tomorrow. Start saying next week, thinking I usually give this a week apart, tomorrow. These are, of course, the incarnations of those who were ready for humanhood on the previous planetary chain, the lunar petries, if you like, the ancestors, the There are many names. In fact, there are 29 names for them, so, you know, you'll get used to calling them by different things. The Bar Hashad's Lunar Petries, the Fathers, the Ancestors, and so on. Altogether, I think there are about 29 or 30 names. So these are simultaneously the secret teachings, as HPB says, page 77 of Volume 2, show the divine progenitors creating men on seven portions of the globe, each on his lot. That is, each a different race of men externally and internally and on different zones. This polygenistic claim is considered elsewhere, and so on. She goes into this. This is page 77 of Volume 2. So we have then this rather different teaching that there is, as it were, from the very beginning of our round, fourth round, different types in terms of stages of consciousness going forth on seven different portions. It's a very mysterious teaching. I'm not going to go into it again, or we'd spend all of our time going back. The second, of course, is a very much simpler one and a much easier one for us to recognize. The birth of the astral before the physical body. Now, I've put astral in quotes because what is being spoken of is not what we came later to term the astral, but what HPB means by it here is the shadow vehicle, the model vehicle, technically the linga sharira, the subtle vehicle, the etheric, if you like, before, of course, its molding into the physical. It gave us the model. Now that's a much easier one to deal with, isn't it? And we have very little problems with that. The third one, and most startling of all, and this is why I've keyed it, because on Friday you're going to be hearing a very outstanding tape dealing with this in terms of contemporary thought. And I'll give you the references, and I will be presenting you with full study notes on the tape, because it really is an extremely interesting presentation of this by one of our leading students, scholars of the secret doctrine, Adam Warkup of England, whom some of you have heard. He has been here and gave us, you remember, a very fascinating series a couple of years ago on the three streams of evolution. This third one, a third proposition, certainly until very recent times, was perhaps the one that could be most denied by science, could be most ridiculed by science. That if these were, you know, out of bounds, well, that's the occultists for you. That's the, you know, the theosophists for you. But the third one, to make such a pronouncement until comparatively recent times, was utterly ridiculous and outlandish. Very startling that man in this round, and we won't go into all the planetary chain business again, but in this round preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. Now, we'll have cause, of course, to refer to these propositions as we proceed, but this concept, which I've just abbreviated, man before ape, was really incredible, as I say, until fairly recently. And that now has much more of a... It's now then our intention to begin an examination of the evolutionary development of humanity as set forth in the stanzas and shlokas of Volume 2. And this is tough work. I said to Diana this morning on the telephone, in fact, that if I was uptight, it's because this is really tough work. this second volume. If you think cosmogenesis was difficult, if you think, you know, the whole cosmic processes, if that was difficult, I can tell you you're in for some really, at least for me, because one needs to be familiar, in one sense, with contemporary developments in anthropology, paleontology, geology, I had a number of others certainly in those, you need to be really quite familiar, because the whole science of these, in these areas, particularly in paleontology and in geology even, but also in anthropology, the theories have really advanced so tremendously since HPB's day, 100 years ago, and even are constantly changing, even now, that you really have to be, well-read in these fields. And quite frankly, I am not. So I'll be really blunt with you. I have tried to keep up. I have tried desperately to keep up with some of it, but it's the fields are moving so rapidly that it's not at all easy. And of course, one of our problems has been, particularly in the field of paleontology, as you may know, that there have been a number of hoaxes. The famous Piltdown Man, the famous Nevada tooth discovery, and all of these things that were later shown to be simply hoaxes. And scientists have been stood on their heads, you see, advancing some marvelous theories out of millions of bones, the fossil record, which is, of course, the famous Nevada tooth, that this was a hominid, showing that the American continent was occupied millions of years ago, and of course it turned out to be the tooth of an ancient pig, you see, not at all human. So that has muddied the field, even for science. So, I think we can laugh right back in their faces when they say some of our theories are ridiculous. Well, you've pinned your hopes on what turned out to be some really pretty stupid things, you see. You've identified bones as one thing, and they've turned out to be something else. So, I think we can snub our noses a bit, too, at the scientists. So, but this has muddied the field, and so it's made it really difficult to say what are some of the latest theories. In any event, at least those areas, anthropology, geology, paleontology, all of that, and I defy any of you to be experts in all of them. So if you're expert in one of them, you can correct me where I'm wrong. I'm a dabbler in all of them. So, as I say, this is no easy task, but we will try to keep in mind certain fundamental propositions as we go along, and it is these, of course, which help us throughout in our exploration. Let me say, first of all, that we can approach this subject, this study, from two points of view, from two directions, rather, not just two points of view, from two directions. Jeffrey Barborka makes this very clear in his little book, The Story of Human Evolution, which is a commentary on some of the shlokas of this second volume. He points out, for example, that you can study the subject of anthropogenesis from the view of the evolutionary development of humanity, that is, in terms of what we call these root races. Or we can study it in terms of the evolutionary development of the principles of the human constitution. Now, there's a subtle difference. Either from the evolutionary development of humanity itself, which will also be in terms of the forms which enshrined or which encased, I should say, the principles, or from the evolutionary development of the principles. Now let me just give you an illustration of what I mean by this. When we come to the third great developmental stage, which we call the root race, and I'm stressing developmental stage because I don't want anyone to go away thinking, as I'm sure you all realize, that we're talking about ethnicity. We're not talking about ethnic groups. We're talking about major developmental stages which really has to have to do with the interior consciousness, the development, the emphasis on a particular consciousness. When we come to the third, we find a great dramatic moment occurs with what is called the incarnation of the Manasaputras. And some of you who've been with me will remember this. We've already discussed it. This coming in of the solar Petris, the great Agnishvati hierarchy, those who were the stimulators of mind, Manas. Manasaputra is the sons of mind, the sons of who have already achieved in a previous system the awakening of Manas. Now, this does not mean that Manas was not present earlier as a principle. And that's why you can study it in the evolutionary development of the principles. Manas was already present. And this raises the question, well, do the Manasaputras incarnate in beings who already had a mind? So you got two minds. Well, many of us are of two minds at times, but maybe even of seven minds at times. But no, it is a very subtle teaching, as we've already discussed, and I'm not going to go back over that. We've already discussed it. But in which Manas was already present, but the principle is stimulated. It is now awakened. It is now taken hold of. It is ensouled, you see. And so you can look at it from this point of view of the evolutionary development of humanity in these stages, or from the point of view of the principles. And now, in effect, we've already studied the development of the principles, because this is given in stanza 7 of the first volume, which starts out, you remember, "Behold the beginnings of sentient life." And that whole stanza, and there's a whole series, of course, on tape of that, where we look then at the development of the principles. So evident, therefore, that HPB gave this prior consideration, because that's part of a reflection, if you like, of the cosmogonical process. Because man, in essence, is the cosmos. We've already talked that. Man is the measure of all things. And so we've taken that up before she brings up the evolutionary development of humanity through the stages that we've come to call the root races. And now the evolutionary development of humanity, however, is particularly set forth in this second series from what she gives as stanza 5 through the end, but what we can say is shlokas 18 through 49. Now, before we take up that, however, this major story, there are again certain preliminaries, and I've put it here in red, because this is what I want to bring up this morning. And incidentally, I have had Xeroxed a number of copies of an introductory paper which I prepared for use for those who are not really familiar with the background that we're talking about of the secret doctrine. And I think it may be helpful, there are four pages of it, setting forth certain propositions and statements that may be helpful in understanding. These are simply necessary to clear the ground, and I think may help us. First of all, what I'm calling the numbering of the shlokas. Now remember this word shloka, of course, should have little accent points there. Simply, you can translate it as verse, the numbering of the verses. This is rather interesting because the stanzas on which HPB bases her commentaries on the genesis and development of our present humanity are given to us in quite a different form. Anyone familiar, having looked at all in Volume 2, will note this. Quite different from the way in which she presented the stanzas and shlokas of Volume 1, that is, that underlay the description of the cosmogonical processes. I'm assuming all of you know that when I speak of the stanzas, I'm speaking of the basis of HPB's work, which is known as the stanzas of Jian. The word Jian, of course, is cognate with Dhyani and is said to have been, therefore, the result, very much like the Vedas, of visions of great rishis, great sages, great lords of meditation, whose perception, you see, the Vedas, the oldest scriptures, particularly the Rig Veda, but all the four Vedas, are said to have been heard by the great rishis. Heard, and then written down, ultimately. And so these stanzas, very ancient, of course, as we know, and HPB tells us they were in a language that predated the earliest of the Indo-European, a language she calls Sensar, of which, incidentally, linguists have no knowledge, and again deny that such a language... they don't deny that such a language existed. They deny that any knowledge of it, because they all recognize there was a language from which all the Indo-European languages, including Sanskrit, derived. That is accepted by linguists. Well, it's evident, for example, that what we have been given in the shlokas of Volume 2, what we've been given is far more incomplete than were even the earlier stanzas. And this is a key point. And I think it's something we have to keep in mind. HPB, for example, states on page 15 of Volume 2, only 49 shlokas out of several hundred are here given. You remember when we were studying Volume 1 and we came to stanza 4, is it stanza 4 or stanza 6? Anyway, stanza 6, the fourth shloka of stanza 6, that between the fourth and fifth shlokas of stanza 6, she said 11 stanzas were omitted. You know, so even there, you remember, I commented that you can't, why does she pick up shloka 5, you see, of stanza 6, when in between 4 and 5, 11 stanzas have been omitted? So the numbering, you know, we can't get hooked on this numbering. Now, she breaks these 49 up into different stanzas, but I'm going to forget about the stanzas because while in Volume 1, she had, for example, stanza 1, shloka 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, stanza 2, and the number of shlokas, 1, 2, 3, etc., and so on. So she always started over. Here, she is going right straight through shlokas 1, 2, 3, on to 49. And there are 49, and she numbers them that way. So we can forget about the stanzas, and I am forgetting about them because I think it's irrelevant. she's broken them up in a different way. But our interest, therefore, is in this progression. And as she says, therefore, several hundred have been omitted. Now, and then she says, not every verse is translated verbatim, which is also quite different from those given us in the first volume. And she says, a periphrasis is sometimes used for the sake of clearness and intelligibility, which is nice to know, because some of them are still quite unintelligible and not at all very clear, where she says, where a literal translation would be quite unintelligible. So we can perhaps be grateful. So, as I say, she has separated these 49 shlokas into 12 sections, or stanzas. The numbering is from 1 to 49, and so I will refer simply to the number of the shloka and forget about the stanza number. I think it makes it easier. Of course, HPB, as I said, divides her commentary according to the number of the section or stanza she's writing about, and it may be confusing from one point of view, but in the long run, I think it will make our task easier. For one thing, there is a great deal of cross-referencing that is absolutely necessary in the consideration of this second set of stanzas, and that is one of the things that's going to be confusing. So that's why I'm using the shlokas only. Sri Madhava Ashish, in his commentary, which I certainly highly recommend, Man, Son of Man, the early part of which was, of course, prepared and written in collaboration with Sri Krishna Prem, before Sri Krishna Prem's death, but the major portion of the manuscript was completed and put into order by Ashish, and so it's only Ashish's name that appears on this one, whereas the two names appear on the first one. But they make a point, and I'll say they, because this is in a part that Prem was also responsible for. Although the significance of this second set of verses is essentially the same as that of the first, the relatively homogeneous symbolic exegesis of the first set has given way to a chaotic mixture of mythology, allegory, and anthropology. Some of the incoherencies can be lessened by rearranging the selection of 49 verses which we have been given. And I am personally very happy with Ashish's rearrangement. I think that it deserves serious consideration for a very real reason. So I will do a lot of cross-referencing, and I hope not to confuse you too much. If I confuse you, it's because I'm already confused myself. So you might as well, I don't know why I should be the only one confused. You might as well be confused too. I like to share my ignorance. You know. It goes around easier. Well, although to some extent, and perhaps to a very large extent, the story unfolded in these shlokas, or verses, of this second volume deals with historical events, and I should put historical, I suppose, in quote marks, because some of it is prehistory. But some of it is verifiable, to some extent, historically verifiable. The essential significance of these ancient verses really lies outside their historical veracity. That, to me, is a very important point, and I want to make it. That it's not so much whether you can verify it historically or not. Do you see? It's always exciting, of course, to discover points of contact between the secret doctrine, metaphysics, and contemporary science, and between the evolutionary story given us in the secret doctrine and modern theories in the fields of anthropology and paleontology. But there's another and a deeper level in the meaning. And this leads to what I call the relevance of the study. It's not just to be familiar with all the ancient myths, and of course, this is another field one has to be really familiar with. That was another one I meant. Anthropology, paleontology, geology, mythology. Yes. Because HPB has everything. Babylonian, Chaldean, Egyptian, Indian, the Puranas, of course, Greek. She's got it all. She's got all of these myths. Judaic, all of this is present here. You have to really, but there's another and a deeper layer of meaning in our study. Because I think we have to keep in mind that the real significance, or the real purpose of these verses is not in their apparent concern with historical, geological, or anthropological events that can be historically verifiable, but it lies in there being what we can only call a symbolic account of movements within our own being. In one sense, what is given us in these 49 shlokas is the history of consciousness. And there's a marvelous work, of course, by one of the great Jungians, Dr. Erich Neumann, on the origin and development of consciousness. And this is the real relevance of its study. What you are looking at, in other words, is not the first root race, but what in our own psychic structure is still present, because these earlier stages are all within us. And sometimes we revert to them, if I can put it that way. They are all in us. They're not out there. They didn't happen millions of years ago. But they are happening now. And so these are concerned with ourselves. And all the stones, waters, mothers, fathers, watermen terrible and bad, all the rest of us are glyphs of the patterns of our inner and outer being, woven by the powers of life itself. So that, as I say, leads me inevitably to the second point to which I want to call your attention. The question is often asked, you see, what is the relevance of the evolutionary record presented to us in these shlokas? At times, as I say, it seems so incredible. The story seems so fantastic as to stretch all our credulity, you see. When we get into this, you see, that the watermen terrible and bad she herself created from the remains of others. The Dianis came and looked, the Dianis from the bright father, mother. Displeased they were, the flames came, the fires of the sparks. They dried out the turbid dark waters. Well, you can read a lot of it, you see, that, and say, you know, this all sounds very strange. The first were the sons of yoga. The second race was the product by budding and expansion. Then the second evolved the egg-born and so on. You know, you go on with all of this. It sounds fantastic. And in addition, the history being retold seems so very remote from our present concerns and problems. You know, whether we're going to survive a nuclear holocaust, peace, and all of that, you see. Is the study, then, of past evolutionary development of any significance at all today? Does it matter what the previous stages in that development have been like? Maybe it's just a kind of picture of what could happen if we do have a nuclear holocaust and we'll all be back to being watermen terrible and bad sort of thing. Well, again, I'd like to quote Ashish in this connection, as I think he expresses very directly and succinctly the relevance. The importance of the stanzas, he says, lies in their being a guide to man's true nature and not in their being a history of evolution on the surface of this planet. In showing us our origins, they also show us our way of return, not through rejection of life, but through the flowering of our still unrealized manhood. Man's physical evolution must form part of the story, for it presents us with a panoramic view of human nature. Spread out before us, we see the patterns of events which spring from and are symbolic representations of the patterns of the human soul. However we like to explain it, the men of the past are present in us, and their psychic patterns are ours. So what it is simply a look at ourselves, how we got to be as we are, and what we can do about it, and where we're going. And that's its relevance. That's page 19 of Man, Son of Man. So our studies, as I say, are really studies of ourselves. To put it in another way, in the terminology to which we've become accustomed in our theosophical studies, we today are just as much first, second, third, and fourth race humans as we are fifth race humans. Just as much. And even in our very genetic structure, and we're all that has been in the evolutionary development, there is one genetic pool. That's incredible. And our study is only to help us disentangle the threads of all that we have been. It's sort of a cosmic, or a, shall we say, a occult DNA. You see, here are these threads, and we are disentangling them to see what. But we're all these earlier races also in our psychological structure, and that's important. Consciousness, too, is composed of strands from those earlier stages of development. And one day, to consciously realize our full potential, we will have to face and deal with, which means to become self-conscious of, those psychological threads. And this is why it has often been said that the adept is one who has untangled the psychological knots, K-N-O-T-S, the psychological knots of his being. And we have them all tangled up. Diana?
The first question of ignorance comes in. The proof of your ignorance is nothing is here without. So you're saying in the seven human groups, are the root races?
No, they are the classes of monads. Which really, in one sense, prefigure, we can say that. They become the archetypal prefiguring of what will be sequentially drawn out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for now.
For now it does. Okay. That may be, yeah.
How do we relate the sub-races to that?
Well, that's within each seven root race there are, we are accustomed to this terminology, seven root sub-races, and within the each sub-race, numerous, as HPB says, numerous branches and branchlets, little twigs, you know. And
so. When do the root races start coming
in? We'll come to that. Okay. Yeah. We've got a lot of preliminary. They come not until about stanza 5, or rather shloka, shloka, what is it, 18. In other words, the first 17 shlokas we're going to have to look at first, you see. But then the sub-races are merely developmental stages within that, you see. It's, maybe I can put it this way. I often think of it, and I'm sure that this is an analogy that has been used many times. We're in a classroom. We're all in a classroom. You see. Now, in some of our schools today, we have what are called different tracts. Are you accustomed to that term? You know, so that you may be along one particular line, you see. You may, Thurley may be, for example, you could be a senior in high school and you're studying for college preparatory. Josie next to you may also be a senior, but is studying for taking a different tract in order to go into vocational school. And Sylvia may be taking a tract to go into medical school, so on. You know, all of these different tracts, but you're all in seniors in high school. You're all fifth root race. But you are doing one development, which is a kind of sub-race. You're doing another, you're doing another. And in that sense, and this is why I want you to have this concept that we're not talking ever, ever about inferior or superior groups. You see, are we going to say that because Josie becomes an assistant manager of a bank, that that is less or greater than Sylvia becoming a medical doctor? These are important, aren't they? You see, I think we've gotten this, and I'm going to be very careful to avoid, you know, this thing of superior and inferior, because I think it's very sad to have it. They may be sequential, because in our world, everything is on a linear time scale, isn't it? Do you see? So it is a sequential development. At the same time, shall we say that the bud of the rose is less perfect than the full flower? As a bud, it is a perfect bud. As a full flower, it's a perfect flower. I know it. As you all know, I'm a radical.
I'm thinking that you're talking about the waterman, the terrible waterman, and all that as being part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the idea that science explains about the recapitulation
in the fetal stomach. That's right. That's right.
All kinds of things.
Yes. That's right. Yeah.
Many,
that's right. It does. It goes through so many. So, of course, we have to be a little bit patient, too, because obviously on this first morning I can't say everything either, you know. So, but it's an important point, I think. So I'm glad you brought it up. But the main thing is that there will come a time when we have to deal with all of these threads within us, these psychological aspects, which we've inherited from our own past. And it's a truly staggering challenge. But I think it places in perspective our present stage of development with all its attendant problems and opportunities. We're on the way. Well, maybe that's a good place to break for. As I've said, the relevance, of course, is because we're looking at ourselves, not only as we were, but as we are, because all we were is present in what we are. Now, at the same time that we're studying ourselves, we're studying the planet, which is our home. And this is a very unique point that should be made, I think, in relation to current knowledge, current ideas, contemporary views, because this is something that's rather interesting. The implications, of course, derive from an essential teaching of the esoteric philosophy, and it's one to which I've frequently referred in earlier talks. The evolutionary development of our planet, Earth, proceeds in exact correspondence with the evolutionary development of the humanity which occupies it at any particular time. And this, of course, you can imagine how startling that idea was 100 years ago. Today, you know, with the ecological development, the Gaia theory, and all sorts of things, where we recognize that we have a direct relationship with the planet. But 100 years ago, the planet was there, you know, all right, we could stand on it, and the forces of gravity kept us on it, you know. And, of course, man would never fly anyhow, because he wasn't meant to. And, you know, there were theologians who were saying that if man had been meant to fly, it would have said so in the Bible, and he would have been provided with wings. And since he wasn't, therefore he was not meant to do this. And, of course, he wasn't meant to go faster than, you know, a horse and buggy sort of thing. That's right, and this is very true. So, you know, we have, but today, you see, we are aware of this. But imagine HPB making such a statement. I think sometimes we have to realize how fantastic these things must have sounded 100 years ago when she came out with these ideas. Now, early on in volume 2, this is page 33 if you want the reference in volume 2, HPB quotes the occult commentary. And for those of you who may not be familiar, I should remark that periodically throughout the volumes, she quotes what she calls simply at times the commentary, and it's always in italics. Sometimes she calls it the occult commentary. In any event, what is genuinely esoteric is never published in words anyway. The genuine esotericism is not that which is conveyed in papers or words. In any event, in this, and this is an easy reference book, particularly if you have the two-volume Secret Doctrine, then you can get this as a quest book. She has quite a section on the books of Cuté and the doctrines of Tsongkhapa and the original sources for the book of Jian and the commentaries which were written thereon. This is section 47. For those who haven't read it, it's fascinating because she gives you the background. These are the folios, the secret folios, the said to be the esoteric folios of Cuté, a great character, a figure, legitimacy as an individual is now becoming rather well established through much of the material that has been published in recent years from Tibetan manuscripts brought out by the Dalai Lama and the many, many lamas and people who came out from Tibet during the great 1959 emigration from Tibet and in the years succeeding that. And one of our members, David Regal, in Ashland, Oregon, has done a considerable amount of study to verify the source of these so far as the exoteric works are concerned, and he has a very interesting little paperback dealing with the authenticity of the books of Cuté. Very fascinating, so that there now is coming to light what was not available in HPB's day, verification of the source material on which at least she based these stanzas and the occult commentary. So when she talks about the occult commentary or the commentary, it's from these esoteric books, what she calls the secret folios of the books of Cuté, of which there are 35 volumes, 14 of which are said to be the esoteric interpretation. Now, that's a long digression to come back to this point of the exact correspondence of the condition of the planet, the evolutionary development of the planet, and the evolutionary development of the humanity occupying it. Early on in volume 2, page 33, HPB quotes this occult commentary, all sentient, complete beings are furnished in their beginnings with forms and organisms in full harmony with the nature and state of the sphere they inhabit. Very clear. Now, the reverse of this must also be true, and is indeed equally true. The sphere inhabited by sentient beings must be in harmony with the nature of those beings. And so, when Diana said a moment ago that what we have done, recklessly done, to our planet reflects to a very large extent what we have done to our own psychological selves. We have injured. I'm glad Felix came in, because Felix quoted something this morning. I hope you can quote it again, Felix, for me, because I think it points this up, a statement what we have lost. Would you quote it for me again, Felix?
I'm not quoting it back then. I can't even remember the man's name, but it was a beautiful statement that when we started to perform cruel experiments on animals in order to relieve human suffering, man separated himself from his most precious possession, his conscience.
I think it's a marvelous statement, because it is, and thank you, Felix, because I was, yes, I'm very glad, because I didn't remember it exactly, and you've given it again. And I think this is, you see, when we talk about the planet we occupy, which is a living organism, we're also talking about all other life, all sentient life that inhabits, that is using this as home. And this is a very important point, so that the connection, you see, I come back, Diana, to what you said about this what we've done with our planet, which is a reflection, a projection of our own psychological mess, if you want to put it that way. And the exploitation of the animals is also a reflection of the exploitation of earlier strands of our own being. So if for no other reason, for enlightened self-interest, if you like to put it that way, we ought to feel responsibility. So there is, as the secret doctrine indicates again and again, a development of our planet and all life pari passu with the development of the sentient beings, particularly the human, who occupy it. And today, as I say, the concept of the planet as a living organism, the so-called Gaia hypothesis, I look at Diane because we've been discussing this very much, has gained, as we know, a great deal of respectability. And we're very much aware of it. Now, then finally, an important point, this D, before we come to the discussion, an important point to keep in mind throughout our studies of Volume 2 relates to the often quite bewildering mass of tangential and correspondential material presented to us by HPB. For example, just let me call your attention to the fact that in dealing with Shloka 2, she goes off into all sorts of additional information for pages upon pages. She gets into first of all talking about Mercury, the Lord of Wisdom, Mercury, or Buddha. And then suddenly she shifts to talking about Venus and Lucifer and the whole Luciferian development. And then she goes on into symbolism of the circle and diameter and the symbols, of course, the astrological symbols for Venus and Earth. And then she goes on into a lot of the numerological interpretation, and all that in that short, those few pages. So, as I say, tangential and correspondential material presented to us. Not only does she draw, of course, on ethnographical and anthropological, factually historical, verifiably geographical knowledge of her time, but she involves us in her commentaries in ancient symbology, mythology, astrology, and very much else. And one can scarcely, as I've already said, be a specialist in all of these areas to which she refers. But great care must be taken in accepting as valid today statements which she makes concerning theories which were current in the last century. And also, even HPB was not infallible. So let us not think that this is, you know, that she was always writing from a point of absolute knowledge. Even a layman's knowledge of contemporary astronomy, for example, as well as developments in that field which have resulted from the space probes of our recent decades, must lead us to acknowledge that many of her statements may be subject to question, and certainly at least to reinterpretation. Today, many diverse theories of evolution are being hotly debated, and while some features of Darwin's theories are still accepted in some quarters, and probably taught in some quarters, by no means all of his theses have stood the test of time. In the fields of anthropology, with ever more refined studies of primitive cultures, from Margaret Mead onwards, and even many of Margaret Mead's theories are being seriously questioned, as you may know, and seriously debated, and many of them thrown out. And in the field of paleontology, with the development of studies in molecular biology, startling new theories are being advanced, some of them supportive of concepts presented by HPB, some of them in direct contradiction. We have to be careful when we say science says this, and HPB says this, and we, you know, want to shout hallelujah when we suddenly find a juxtaposition that seems to fit nicely. Because tomorrow some scientist may come up with something else that throws the jigsaw puzzle into disarray again. So we have to be cautious on this. In geology also, with the evidence now derived from the theory of plate tectonics, the movement of land masses, advances in knowledge have been made that may ultimately demand, I think, a total reinterpretation of the legends of Lemuria and Atlantis and other sunken continents. We may be even now standing on a piece of Lemurian soil, and it's known in plate tectonics that there are portions of Idaho that are probably Atlantean. I always thought that when I visited Idaho, but now that there is now a reformation and a movement about. So we may have to reinterpret a great deal, and we must not be afraid to do that. Yes, Diana, I am radical, you see. From one point of view, one can imagine, of course, how exciting it would be to be writing the secret doctrine today with all the knowledge now available to us. And one does wonder what HPB and her teachers would have presented if the knowledge that we have available to us had been current 100 years ago. One may say, well, didn't her teachers already know? That's not the point. The point is that it had in some way to fit the consciousness of the time.
Well, if you think that the vocabulary and the way in which things are done to them is so different that it's hard to make them fit together.
It is.
So you may realize that underneath there is something.
Yes. That's right. Now, in that connection, let me just refer you to these two very interesting new works in the field of paleontology, books dealing with the new theories. I've already mentioned the monkey puzzle. And this, of course, is based on what is thought to be really a very important discovery in the evolutionary theories, because instead of using evidence from fossils, which has been the system, you see, among paleontologists for generations practically, to piece together hundreds of bits of little fossils, you know, pieces, now there is, in this new field of, since the discovery of DNA, which is really comparatively recently, a whole field of molecular biology. And this has revealed that the genetic material of the genetic material of man, the chimp, and the gorilla differ by perhaps only 1%. This will be dealt with on Friday when we take up that tape. And really, it's quite startling, because perhaps then man did come before ape. And this is indeed an idea that scientists are willing to at least speculate about. Because why this similarity of genetic material? Because of this, first of all, the sin of the mindless in the third root race, and secondly in the fourth, this mating of conscious, self-conscious, possessed of mind, humans mating with the progeny of that sin of the mindless, the anthropoid and the anthropoid ape. So that these, the chimpanzee and the gorilla, are not some missing links or our distant ancestors, but they are our evolutionary brothers. Which is what, you know, it's fascinating. And this is an exciting book, The Monkey Puzzle. Really exciting. The other one that I've put up there is The Bone Peddlers. This is also really quite exciting. The Bone Peddlers, Selling Evolution, by William R. Fix. And Fix holds an MA degree in behavioral science from Simon Fraser University in Canada, and really deals with this whole question of the study of fossil man, the history of paleoanthropology. And it's a fascinating account of the history of paleoanthropology. And he observes, of course, the many times questionable authenticity, of some of the proposed ancestors. And then the hoaxes, you see, Piltdown Man, which was, of course, exposed as a hoax, Hesperopithecus, who was this Nevada candidate, discovered to be an extinct pig, and so on, you see. So he is talking about the need, therefore, to examine consciousness, and that will not be done by examining the millions of bone fragments. His first part is called A Tour of the Bone Room. It's absolutely marvelous. He writes easily. It talks about the dating and the contextual dating, along with fluoride dating and other systems of dating. And now the most widely talked about dating technique, which is the potassium-argon method. And really, literally, millions of fossils that are trying to be pieced together. But it's his conclusion that I think is really is really the outstanding thing, that what we have to do is to recognize that for all of this piecing together, we still have not produced what is essentially the human, that our uniqueness lies in our brains, tongues, and hands that have allowed us to accumulate this knowledge. It's a very interesting thesis, and he has a marvelous diagram of the, as he says, how one missing link succeeds another in the bone game, sort of thing. But it brings you up to date. I've given you the dates here. You can see the monkey puzzle is not new, 82, and this is 84. So this deals with some of the latest, in this field at least. Now, therefore, this is still part of this, with all of these factors in mind, we have to take cognizance of what HPB herself states at the very outset of her commentaries on these shlokas that she gives us. Speaking of the shlokas and the commentaries, and this is on page 22 of volume 2 in a footnote, so it's right at the outset, she says, "All the words and sentences placed in parentheses and square brackets in the stanzas and commentaries are the writer's," that is HPB's. "In some places they may be incomplete and even inadequate, but in the meaning attached to them in trans-Himalayan esotericism, they are correct." So we have to keep that in mind. "In every case, the writer takes any blame upon herself, having never claimed personal infallibility. That which is given on her own authority may leave much to be desired in the very abstruse cases where too deep metaphysics is involved. The teaching is offered as it is understood." And I think this is one of the keys to the way in which she worked, too. Now, there are points where she says she didn't understand. I'll come to that in a moment. But she did present, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do in one sense, as I understand. So, and she says, "And as there are seven keys of interpretation to every symbol and allegory, that which may not fit a meaning, say from the psychological or astronomical aspect, will be found quite correct from the physical or metaphysical." Well, I think that's sort of reminiscent of some of the statements in her letters. And if you've never read her letters, at least the published volume of HPB's letters to A.P. Sinnott, and you want a good time, you should read them. I mean, they're delightful. They really are. Of course, they contain a lot of teaching, but they also contain the very human side of HPB. Writing to Mr. Sinnott in late 1886, and this is when she was working on the secret doctrine, she says, "Ever since you left, Master has made me add something to the old manuscript so that much of it is new, and much more that I do not understand myself." In an earlier letter to Sinnott, in which HPB deals with the symbology of numbers, which I think is one of the funniest letters there, she says, "I am given things of which I have no more idea than of the mathematical value of my children." Why? Now, she puts the word children in quotes. I don't know why, but amusingly enough, that letter is signed. You know, she signs her letters in nice ways now and then. Instead of signing it "Yours HPB" or "Yours Blavatsky" or something, she signs it "Yours 530550.
Joy, I was just wondering, it's just a guess. Through the same collection of letters, she constantly refers to the varying number of children that she was accredited with.
Well, yes.
A medical examination proved that she was unable to bear children.
Yes.
So sometimes she had one, sometimes yes, two, sometimes
that's right,
three.
Yes.
It may be referring
I think
to the mathematical number of her children.
I think that's what she is referring to. Well, there's very much additional and, of course, explanatory material, particularly on the planetary chains and the rounds and so on, given in the letters to Sinnott. I really someday will take, probably be able to correlate that with what she gives us here.
Seems to me there's one other consideration too, and that is the fact that science is self-changing.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And so I
put that all under interpretations. This is interpretations both of the what we'll call the doctrine, and science. I think there are the two aspects, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Because science is all the time changing its mind, quite obviously, and developing new. Now, this doesn't always mean that the old theories are completely thrown out. There may be a change of the interpretation of them, or the understanding of them, or the presentation of them, or we may build on them to come to new theories. But I think that we have to work out, ultimately, our own interpretations.
That reminds me of the quotation from some modern scientist, I can't remember his name now, but he said it's like like a dance, and new steps are introduced all the time. It doesn't mean that the old ones are completely abandoned.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's a good point. Yes.
This is not all. It all depends upon our awakening of our own consciousness.
It does. It really does.
Expansion of consciousness.
Yes, Edna's saying it all depends on the awakening of our own consciousness, and it does, and our expansion of consciousness. And Edna, of course, was mentioning during the break the works of Teilhard de Chardin and his Phenomenon of Man, which is, of course, again, a tremendous breakthrough, all of his writings, but in that. Well, these are considerations that I think we need to keep in mind, and I've spent the introductory day on them, but I felt they're so important they should be stressed. In addition, I'd like to take a little time to recall three essential doctrines which were presented to us in the 40 pages which separate the discussions of shlokas 4 and 5 of stanza 6 in volume 1. This begins on page 152 of volume 1, and it continues for some little way. Continues to page 191. Yes, there are 40 pages. 40 pages there. And I suggest that you go back and read them. You can read 40 pages tonight. or at least sometime before we get on further into these shlokas. They deal with three very essential doctrines which are basic to our study of human evolution. First of all, they concern the planetary chains and rounds. And this is extremely important, and I will merely call your attention to the fact that although we have generally pictured the planetary chains, as you remember, we've generally pictured them as a kind of garland, so that we see them that way, and we, see this one round is that, and so on. And from one point of view, that's a useful way to see them, as you know. We have to remember a very important point with regard to these, and that is that, as HBB tells us very clearly, again, I think I have the reference here, yes, volume 1, page 166, that these globes are in coadjunition although not in consubstantiality with our globe. Well, that's an extremely important point, because coadjunition simply means that they are interlocked. They are interconnected, but they are not of the same substance. And in the very interesting pamphlet, a little pamphlet by E.L. Gardner, Whence Come the Gods, he deals with this and presents a diagrammatic representation which in effect suggests that if you take our present planet, the Earth, these are, and then there's one out this way and one back in that way, do you see? So that you get, if you make a nice mobile, there's one that comes out here in front and one that goes out in back, so to speak. So that they are in coadjunition, but not consubstantiality. So they are all present here in some respect. Now that whole doctrine of the planetary chains, you see, we know there's a much we really don't know too much about in this, and of course remember HPB says that among the 11 stanzas omitted is one dealing with the formation of the planetary chains, so she left that all out. And then the second doctrine that is presented, that comes back to this simultaneous evolution and is very important for our understanding, is the doctrine of monadology, as I call it, the doctrine of the monads. What is meant by that? And that's tough. Don't think it's going to be easy, but, you know, who asked for it to be all easy? You know, the further you get along, you see, you know, by the time you're in graduate school, you may wish you were back in kindergarten at times, but you can't do that. You've got to keep going, and we've gotten to this point, so it means we've got to stretch our minds. And the third is an extremely important doctrine, and I call it the doctrine of the triple evolutionary scheme. And that is very important for the work we will be studying. HPB points out very clearly there is a triple evolutionary scheme, interwoven, interblended, the monadic or spiritual, the intellectual or monastic, and the physical or biological. Biological or physical. So that this is going on, you see, simultaneously, a triple evolutionary scheme. And to keep that in mind helps us through volume 2, because sometimes we will be talking about the monadic evolution, and sometimes about the physical evolution, and sometimes about the intellectual, monastic, or psychological evolution. But they're interblended. And so here again are threads we're trying to take apart. But this triple evolutionary scheme is an extremely important one for the theosophical point of view. And you see how it expands the whole concept of evolution. That just, you know, from the scientist's point of view, just deals with, you know, the physical man, and the gorilla, and the chimp, and so on. All of which is important, but it's this interior evolution, monadic and intellectual or monastic, or as I call it, psychological evolution. Very important. Now those three are presented to us in those 40 pages. Not in total, but at least the beginning of them. At times it will be necessary to refer to them. Now, one other thing I'd like to call your attention to. In the October 1985 issue of The Theosophist, which may not be in the library yet, but those who get The Theosophist Air Mail will have this, there's a very interesting article, quite up to date, by Dr. Kumar, B. Kumar, who is at Ranchi University, a member of the society in India, called The Age of the Earth, and it's a comprehensive study in theosophical and scientific estimates. And he gives the occult chronology, and then the Hindu chronology, and then the variations in scientific geological time scale as given by Nigel Calder in his book The Restless Earth, which is a comparatively recent book. I think it was published in 1982 or 83. It's a comparatively recent book, so it's quite up to date. So he's given those three, the occult chronology as given in the secret doctrine, Hindu chronology, and then the scientific geological time scale. And then he compares the occult and scientific data.
Was that in the October?
October 1985, yes, The Theosophist. Just came, what was it, last week or something, I think, because we get the airmail edition of it. So I just call that to your attention because it gives you some a ready reference, very easy reference. Bill?
Do you think there's any correlation between the astral and the virtual particles in quantum mechanics?
I really don't know. Anyone else want to... Bill has asked if I think there's any connection between the astral and what are known in quantum mechanics as the virtual particles. How would you define a virtual particle, Alan?
Virtual particle. Particle that appears
It seems to appear. Yes, it seems to appear and then disappear, doesn't it? Yes. Yeah.
And it annihilates
itself. Yes. There may be. I'm really not certain. I think this, of course, also raises the question of because it does annihilate itself, the existence of antimatter in the universe, and some have suggested that that may be equated with the astral. I don't think so, frankly, and I base it on a statement by Dr. Timney in, I think it's Man, God, and the Universe, but also on the teaching in the secret doctrine based on the lokas and talas, that is to say the regions which seem to correspond in a negative state with those that appear in a positive state, so that there would be a negative astral as much as a positive astral, so to speak, if you want to put it that way. This is all theory, I think.
But Joy, I was just going to suggest to Bill that he may find some clues. I don't think there's any connection between what you're talking about on the astral level, so much as if you read a book called Stalking the Wild Pendulum.
Itzhak Bentov, yes.
Suggests certain things which are very relevant, because the point is that the central theme of that is that vibration has three aspects, that is, the movement that we see, and the change of direction at each end of the cycle of the vibration, and where you have infinite acceleration. And that takes it into a different space-time continuum. Therefore, if you have higher vibrations, you could have a whole order, different order of existence, following the same line of reasoning. But if you haven't read it, I suggest you read Stalking the Wild Pendulum, and then extrapolate from that into higher orders of vibration, and you've got the astral level.
Yes, it's one that I've often referred to, Bill, when we were talking about cosmogenesis, you remember. Bentov, of course, had given a seminar at Alcott on some of that material in Stalking the Wild Pendulum. Marvelous work. And then was tragically killed very young in an air accident, you remember, in Chicago.
Was he?
No, it was a major air disaster in Chicago. couple of years ago.
He was a non-scientist, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. There's one other that his widow published from notes which he left called A Cosmic, and the S is sort of up, so you can read it as a comic or a cosmic book. I've forgotten the full title of it. It's a clever little work because he was a very, very creative sort of person. But his widow published that after his very sad death. John?
HPV refers to mercury, and she spells the word B-U-D-H-A.
Yes, B-U-D-H-A.
A little bit later on, she spells the word B-U-D-D-H-A, but she doesn't refer to that as mercury.
No, that's not mercury. Yes, it's rather interesting, and I think she does that to distinguish, because, of course, the original is that, you see, which is simply wisdom, knowing. And this is, of course, fundamentally the one who knows, so that it's a different, it's from the same word, but this she always uses when she speaks of Mercury or the Lord of Wisdom.
Well, do I take a jump from that then?
And this is
the sun. Would that be the source of Mercury's knowledge?
I wouldn't necessarily jump that way.
Yes.
Well, perhaps the astro. Yes, that may be true.
So we have been created by an astrologically functioning.
Oh, there's no doubt that one of the keys is astrological. There's no question of that.
Okay. Well, I seem to be all right. Okay. All right.
And this is the quality which enables us to become a Buddha. This is just as from one point of view, the Manasaputras incarnated to stimulate Manas, so there are Dhyanis who will incarnate to stimulate Buddhi. Well, not technically, because this will be self-stimulated to become the Buddha. But a preceding.
Which one was Sinnott referring to in his
esoteric Buddhism? He was referring to this. He was referring, in a sense, HBB says he was really referring to wisdom per se.
Well, there's an argument. I never did find out what the outcome of it all was.
Well, it should have been written. The argument was that it should have been esoteric Buddhism with 1D. That's the way HPB says it should have been entitled, which had to do with the wisdom tradition.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's
mixed up with
religion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or points? I don't want to. Tomorrow I want to start in with Shloka 1, so if you want to read it between now and tomorrow, you may. The first four shlokas, which I think we'll be able to deal with, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 3 days, it'll be the first four shlokas, which I call Pattern and Plea. It's a nice, you know. So tomorrow we start Pattern and Plea. And I think that will take us through the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday we'll come back to looking at this very closely. But I think these will help you, these 3 days will help you to really get in a little bit to this very early stage. It establishes the pattern, and out of that comes then the next stage, which is the plea, you see, which Earth says, please, my house is empty, give me some people. You see, that's the plea. The biggest mistake, that's right, the biggest mistake the earth ever made was to ask for people. Should have had an empty house, you know. But anyway, that's what happened. And then we get the response, of course, of the Lord of the Shining Face, Solo Logos, who says, yeah, I'll give you some, but you're not ready yet. I this is my own translation of the shlokas.
That takes in the first four.
The first four. We'll be talking the next 3 days on the first four. Mm-hmm. So, and we've got a lot to talk about, which includes the seven sacred planets, includes the geological changes. So we've got a lot to do in 3 mornings, but we'll see if we can pack it in. Okay, thank you very much.